Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club In Forum. Connect your intellect, findable online, hard to believe, at commonwealth.club, commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I am Daniel Handler, your moderator. Thank you. That's enough of that. I am a native San Franciscan, so it is always a pleasure to be in the Castro Theater where I've been going forever. But 20 years ago, you were probably more likely to find me at the Hollywood Laundromat about four blocks away, where once a week I would go with my housemates and we would get a drink at the Orbit Room and be told by the Orbit Room that we weren't to take it to the laundromat, and we would take it to the laundromat and order a pizza, which we are also not allowed to do, and sit and drink our drinks and eat our pizza and read Savage Love in the SF Weekly. It was an essential part of my romantic and sexual education and makes me the sexual dynamo I am today. You can ask any of the person I have slept with in the past 20 years. Dan Savage is also a dynamo. He continues to write his column, of course, as well as for other publications of widely shifting prestige, and has widened his spectrum to include other efforts, most notably the It Gets Better project. An Emmy Award-winning series of videos directed at LGBT youth, which has gained more than 50 million views. If each view were a sperm, I would be like almost four male orgasms. His latest book, American Savage, not coincidentally for sale this evening, casts its gaze even wider. It tackles just about every topic that has earned him the praise and the ire and the panicked ambivalence of anyone who reads his sharp-fanged, hilarious, delightful prose. It is a terrific read. This is a terrific night. Please welcome the terrific Dan Savage.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Come on out. Wait, one guy blinked.
Oh, just a second. See, I have a 15-year-old son now, so every time I speak in front of a large group of people, I take a picture of that large group of people, and I text it to him and say, some people listen to your father.
How is it having a 15-year-old son when you're a sex columnist?
It's mortifying for him, but in an age-appropriate way. My dad was a Catholic deacon, and that was mortifying for me, so I empathize with what he's going through. My dad was on the altar every Sunday at the church that was attached to the parish where we went to school. My siblings and I were held to higher standards by the nuns because our father was a deacon and our mom was a lay minister. And it was embarrassing and mortifying. And so now I'm paying that forward and embarrassing and mortifying my own son.
One can only wonder what he will do when he mortifies his offspring. I'm glad you started with the Catholic Church because I wanted to ask you to explain the Catholic Church to me.
In what faith were you raised?
Kind of flaky Jew. And so the ways of Gentiles are strange to me. But you talk very movingly and also furiously about the Catholic Church, and I think that it's kind of every Catholic I meet in San Francisco has this fierce and yet not quite detached relationship.
No, nobody but a Catholic can speak fiercely and movingly, I think,
right.
And angrily. Oh, who's behind me?
It's just the Pope. It's not a big deal.
It's your shitty new cardinal. He's come to kick me in the head.
Thanks.
Cardinal Drunk Driver. What's his fucking name?
We're just down.
Awesome. The Catholic Church, ladies and gentlemen, it'll be here for the next two millennia, unfortunately. You know, I was raised Catholic at Cars of Deep Groove in you. My mother was a Catholic and a believer and very devout in her own way. She was a liberal American Catholic, pro the ordination of women, pro the use of birth control after she had four kids in 3.5 years in four separate pregnancies. She came around on the birth control issue.
Better late than never.
Yeah, better late than never. It was, in a way, sometimes I feel like I call myself a Catholic just to annoy Brian Brown and the Pope and other Catholics. But it was my Jewish friends.
I'm assuming people are cheering for the annoyance of Brian Brown.
Yes, yeah, not for Brian Brown. Yeah. But it was my Jewish friends who brought me around in that. When I moved to Seattle to help start The Stranger, which is where my column began in the very first issue, I'd had Jewish kids in the neighborhood growing up, but I didn't really know them very well. And there were Jewish kids in our Catholic school who the nuns would literally say, and he's going to hell and it's very sad, and point to the Jewish kid in the room as an example of what would be burning in hell. But I met, I had these friends, and we got to be really good friends, and they were atheists. They didn't believe in God or the Messiah. They ate a lot of bacon, but they would do Rosh Hashanah, and they would get together for the holidays. And I couldn't wrap my head around that, because I was still in the I will not walk into a church, and if I have to go to a funeral, I'm going to sit there, and I'm not going to kneel or stand. And what I got from them was, oh, this is about our cultural identity as Jews, and we can do a little Jewish floor show every once in a while and tap into the generations and feel connected. And I was like, oh, I could be culturally Catholic. And I can do a little hocus pocus without meaning it, just like my Jewish friends do.
Right. Yeah. Does it give you hope that there's a burgeoning kind of cultural Catholicism?
Oh, God, I don't know. Maybe it would be good if there was a burgeoning cultural Catholicism, because American Catholics are, of all the denominations, the most supportive of marriage rights and workplace protections and equal rights for LGBT people. Catholics more than any other denomination,
right.
Which is hilarious when you consider how sort of doubling and tripling and quadrupling down the hierarchy and the bishops and the archbishops are being on hate. And the American Conference of Bishops and that Dolan motherfucker in New York. We're getting into the Catholic rabbit hole here.
Is that a euphemism? I can't tell. well, you mentioned...
It is if you nickname your altar boy Rabbit, I guess.
Oh, man.
Rabbit run.
Now you got a secular Jewish guy also thinking you're going to hell.
With that Jewish kid from my fourth grade class.
If you liked him then, he'll be there. You mentioned starting up A Stranger, and I'm curious about that, because you've said a bunch of times that you kind of started being an advice columnist as a joke.
Absolutely.
And when did the joke stop being funny for you?
When the column started, the idea was I was going to be this gay guy giving advice to straight people. And I would treat straight people and straight sex with the same contempt and revulsion that straight advice columnists had always treated gay people and gay sex with. And I would be very abusive and dismissive and treat straight people with contempt. And this was a new experience for straight people, and they loved it.
Yeah.
And after about a month, because the first month you're writing a column no one knows to send you letters.
Right.
So the first month all the letters were fake and people on the staff wrote them and sent them to me. But then the mail just started pouring in. And the column was just in Seattle. And I was getting hundreds of letters every week when it was just in Seattle. And it was about 2 years into it before I was like, oh, I can't just fuck around anymore. I'm gonna have to go to the library and look shit up. I write in the book, there's a whole chapter where I go into how wrong I was about bisexuality. So if there's any angry bisexuals here to throw a chair at me, read the book, you'll be so happy. But I go into one of the mistakes I made was I put the clitoris in the wrong place. It's not here, apparently.
Yeah.
I didn't have guest experts then that I could call, like Carol Queen. And so I unpack where I thought the clitoris was, and I was wrong about that, and my readers let me know. And
well, I mean, one thing that I think set you apart, the reason why you're fun to read in the laundromat with your friends, is because you were willing not to be serious. I feel there was, in kind of the dawn of sex columns, you would read a very juicy question, and then the answer would be this extremely tedious, tepid, dull, shameful answer. And
Ask Isadora, I think that's called, for shorthand.
Yeah.
Ooh. Advice columnists are like vampires. We all hate each other. It's true. It's like, Prudy can't stand me and I can't stand Prudy. And everybody hates Carolyn Hacks.
I assume that was only in my head.
No. Every time you read some other advice columns, you're like, wrong answer, because it should written to me.
But I was reading...
can I just say really
quickly? Yeah, say whatever you want.
The thing that I did, and consciously did with the column when it started, was I'm going to let people use the language they actually use when they talk about sex, and I'm going to use the language that I use when I talk about sex with my friends. And I'm going to, and that's how we sort of, when the column sort of shifted from like a one-note joke in the first 6 months to this other thing, she's like, well, I'm just going to not slip into sexual Sanskrit. I'm not going to be polite. I'm going to use the sort of generally accepted profanities. And I think those are less graphic in a way. There was a rival advice columnist in Seattle briefly who was trying to do me without doing me, and she was in a much more polite newspaper, and I would say sucked my dick or cocksucker in the column, you know, you sucked cocksucker. And she...
I know what a cocksucker.
Okay, well, I was just... right? And she wrote a column where she said, she used this, and this phrase still sticks in my mind because it's horrible. I licked his penis. Which you just imagine someone going... Like it's some horrible ice cream cone, right?
Yeah.
And that's so much more graphic than I sucked his dick. I licked his... And that's what I wanted to do in my column, was let people use the language they actually use and be funny, because when you talk about sex with your friends in a bar when you're drunk, which is how I think of the column, you make jokes, because sex makes people feel tense and implicated. And so to have a little release every while, make a joke at your own expense or at each other's expense, take the piss out of each other.
But it seems like you go beyond that, because it's not only in your answers, but I mean, you're so wonderful at calling bullshit on your questioners. And I wondered, I coincidentally just read this thing that Daniel Mendelsohn said, another Daniel and another critic. And he said, you're trained as a gay person to smell bullshit a mile away. And I wondered if growing up gay and perhaps Catholic makes it easier for you to call bullshit. Do you think you have a better instinct for that?
But Catholic is so much bullshit that you'd think you'd be so desensitized to bullshit you couldn't smell it. Growing up gay, you have to make a close observation of the world and the people in it, and you get very good at sort of seeing you're wearing a mask, and the assumption you start making is everyone else is too, and what's really going on. You know, when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, and I was, or 15, 16, 17, I was out to some friends, and I was sneaking into gay bars, and I would leave the house, and I would, like, take my straight face off and leave it on the porch and put my gay face on and go out with my friends, and then I'd get home, and I'd put my straight face back on and walk into my house. And then I just started looking at my parents going, I wonder what happens when they leave the house. And you start looking at the world that way, that there's a private, secret inner life, and it can't just be gay people that have this private, secret inner life.
Right.
Other people must, too. And you just stare at people on the bus going, I wonder whose penis they've licked.
Because on public transportation, who doesn't think that,
right? Or whose doorknob they've licked.
And what mask do you see happening in the opposition? I rewatched for the second time your dinner table debate with Brian Baron, which, for people who don't know, Brian Baron is the head of the National Organization for Marriage and
raving bigot.
And raving bigot. And you, after some kind of online volleys, he agreed to come to your house for dinner and debate you on whether Christianity was
bad for gay people.
Bad for gay people. And it's the whole debate, an hour long, is on YouTube. And for me, anyway, it's great to watch in like kind of 45-second chunks where you can then kind of pace around the house.
I've never watched it.
You were there.
To watch it. And I had no desire. I have no desire to relive it. Even writing the chapter in the book about it, I didn't sit down and watch it. I just couldn't take it. It was the worst day of my life. In a way, it was just so tense. And what happened was, you know, I said there's bullshit in the Bible to 3,000 high school journalists, and 22 walked out, which on Fox News became a mass walkout of Christian kids.
Not since the Black Panthers had Fox News seen such a large population.
Right. And Brian Baron challenged me to a debate anytime, anywhere. And what he wanted, and he thought I was stupid enough to give him, is their whole shtick now is they're the oppressed ones and we're the intolerant ones. And he wanted me to say the Castro Theater at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. And I would fill it with queers, and we would boo and hiss Brian Brown. He wouldn't get a word in edgewise. And then he'd release that video and go, look how intolerant they are of my intolerance. And I'm stupid, but I'm not that stupid. I could see what he was trying to do. So I said, oh, yeah, anytime, anywhere, my house after dinner, where there'll be no crowd, because I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of that video. And I didn't, and this is in the book, I shouldn't give too much away, but I didn't think he would take me up on it, because I didn't think he was that stupid.
Right.
Because I knew that I would win that debate just on the visuals, just on the optics. Like, here's my, I'm the, like, gay devil. Like,
right.
The Family Research Council puts videos out about me and what a devil, monster, asshole, faggot I am. And, like, here's my house, and it's very Ozzy and Harriet. There's my grandparents' furniture that I inherited. Like, it's very boring. There's not a sling over the dining room table and four goats under it.
Right.
Which is what they imagine. And I didn't think he would accept this invitation, because he would have to acknowledge my humanity and meet my husband and my son. So I didn't tell Terry.
You just said I met kind of an uptight guy the other day and I invited him over.
So, no, I just like, Brian Brown said, okay. And I was like, oh, fuck. And I, you know, I had to go home, and you never get, how often do you get to say, honey, guess who's coming to dinner?
And what do you, he is,
And Terry wins the debate. Read the chapter. Terry wins the debate.
It's true, he does. I would say that your summary, or your chapter on it is much more of an entertaining and lively read, sadly, than the debate itself, which is, at least for me, every time the camera was on Brian Brown, I had to kind of do some deep breathing, not only because of his noxious views, but he really seems like a strange person.
He is a strange...
He's
a big ball of rage, and he's a Catholic convert, which Catholics, born Catholics, don't like Catholic converts.
Yeah.
They're always more Catholic than the Pope.
Same with Jews.
Really?
Yeah. It is. It's like there's no fervor like that of a convert.
Yeah.
Right? You know, who's like, it's Shmini Atzeret. You're like, real Jews don't celebrate that.
And he's a ball of rage. And, you know, I can't peer into his head or Marcus Bachmann's head. But you just get this sense from people like that, that they are externalizing their internal conflict. And they direct all this rage at people who do not have that internal conflict, that they are so trying to tamp down whatever it is that Brian Brown wants sexually in his life. And I don't know what that is. He's had 7 kids by his wife. Maybe that's it. But you just get this sense that there's something that he's fighting, and he's sort of transferred that battle, you know, outside himself. And it projects all this anger and fury and resentment on you and on us, on queers and straight people who are into queers and support queers. He fucking hates this and who we are, and considers it like a personal attack and a personal affront. And it's so hard to be in the room with that kind of psychotic, externalized inner conflict, anger, rage bomb.
Because I must say, all those people seem vulnerable to me. And I don't mean to dismiss their horrible, horrible doings and sayings. But and Maggie Gallagher, who had Brian Brown's job before Brian Brown did, was subject to a long piece in Salon that laid out her own
by Mark
personal
narrative.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which is clearly a disappointing one for her, that she had a child out of wedlock and has been furious with regret over it. And I just think, I think with just about everyone you see who gets up in the morning, it's kind of one thing to me if you're just your average homophobe, but if you actually get up in the morning and are kind of homophobic for a living all day long, what is that?
Yeah. It's really, I'm actually kind of, do you know who Peter LaBarbera is?
Yeah.
The head of Americans for the Truth about Homosexuality. He's obsessed with me and Terry and our dicks and what we do with them. There's a whole section on his website just dedicated to us, which is deeply creepy. But we've sort of become Twitter buddies, and we spar with each other, and we've kind of hate flirt.
And this is the beginning of a terrible romantic comedy.
Yeah, really.
Right now.
And I do think that there's this desire on his part and the part of a lot of them to be in the room with us. They want our attention. There's a reason Marcus Bachmann does ex-gay therapy counseling, because he really wants to be in a room alone with a dude. And this is the only way he can have that.
Right. It's a sad story.
It is a very sad story, and they're ridiculous and pathetic, and we should talk about it all the time. We should call them gay all the time, because if we get it into the heads of young homophobes that if you're outwardly homophobic as an adult, people will think you're a faggot. Even if they are homophobic, they'll tamp it down because they don't want anyone to think they're gay.
Homophobic is the new gay, I guess is what that is.
Right. No, it is. Ted Haggard, Larry Craig, George Reekers, Marcus Bachmann dancing down the hall.
Right.
And some people think it's like, you know, we shouldn't make fun of Marcus Bachmann for being so hysterically swishy, but, and I like swishy guys. Anybody who's ever met Terry knows. I've always been into, like, effeminate guys and swishy guys. I don't understand guys who aren't into effeminate guys. I love femmy guys. The International Space Station goes over our house, and some Russian goes, "Look at that fag." And so I don't think it's an insult to say a guy is effeminate. And
that's a profound relief to me. Yeah.
But some people say it's homophobic the way we pick on Marcus Bachmann. But Marcus Bachmann and his vile wife, they're the ones who are profiting from maintaining homophobia, like pumping it up, keeping it going. And so I think that if we can turn that homophobia back around on them, that homophobia they work so hard to sustain, the cultural sort of poison, and we can turn that back around on them, we can hoist him with his own fucking fruity petard. I think we should do that. We should point at Marcus Bachmann and go, "Ha ha ha, why should you be the only married gay man in Minnesota?"
Well, obviously, and you have a chapter about this in the book, the kind of triumph of your ha-ha-ha is over Rick Santorum. And, I mean, that was incredible to watch as a reader of Dan Savage from kind of early sniping at him. To really realizing...
All power to my readers, though. It was a reader who said, right. Literally, I quoted, the letter is so prescient. In the book, this guy wrote this letter. It's like, everyone's forgetting about him comparing gay couples to dog fuckers and child rapists. George Bush had like come out and said something in support of him. The AP had declared the Santorum AP scandal over, and the pundits were saying move on. And this guy wrote this letter. He's like, we don't want people to ever forget this. Let's memorialize it by redefining his last name. And I stuck that in the column. And then the readers sent in suggestions, and the readers voted and picked that one that stuck. And there's an interview with the guy who wrote that definition, the frothy mix of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes the byproduct of anal sex. And he has never, every once in a while, he and I over the years have exchanged an email. He's never spoken publicly about it. Because personally and professionally, he would be harmed if he came out.
It's Marcus Bachmann, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. He's a deep cover operative for the homosexual conspiracy.
That is some deep cover. and do you wish that it had gone further? What are your feelings about where you are with Santorum right now?
I love Santorum. It couldn't have gone further. Like, he started running for president, and the stories were all about his Google problem, and, you know, you had Maddow and Jon Stewart joking all the time about his Google problem, and it was so fucking delicious. And then every time, which you don't put in a sentence with Santorum anymore,
no.
Every time, was he using... flavored lube that's really strong. Every time they wrote about the Google problem, they had to write about the 2003 or 2006 AP interview. And right. So that reader who said, let's hang this around his neck forever, was right. And by doing this, we did. And he constantly has to answer for that interview because of his Google problem.
Well, you actually talk in the chapter a little bit about how regularly the Santorum Google problem came about as a result of Rick Santorum's opposition to gay marriage.
That's what people say.
Which is really quite the whitewash of Rick Santorum and the problem.
Yeah, the right-wing blogs say we did it because he opposed gay marriage, which is ridiculous because Barack Obama opposed gay marriage in 2008, and we wrote him checks and voted for him en masse. It wasn't about gay marriage. But they right. want, the people who say it's about gay marriage, the right-wing blogs and National Review, and Maggie Gallagher wrote a column saying that, they're just trying to make us look like irrational anger monsters who are going to come after you hammer and tongs if you don't agree with us about everything. It's like, no. You can be against gay marriage and we can have a lively and reasonable debate about that. You compare me to a child rapist and a dog fucker. Not compare me. You compare my marriage, my relationship of 10, 15, 20 years to raping dogs, and I'm going to come after you hammer and tongs. I'm going to hang something like the frothy mixer moves from fecal matter around your neck. And one of the things that's been written about widely is that us punching him in the face really freaked him out because he was used to punching us without ever getting punched back. And now they call me a bully because he was punching us in the face and I punched him in the nose. And I forgot I was talking about marijuana's legal in Washington State.
You were talking about Pink Floyd. That awesome song. I want to talk a little bit about It Gets Better, and you kind of move in the book from the It Gets Better project to talking about sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And those are interesting issues to me that I want to get to. But one thing that has struck me with the It Gets Better project is how different in tone it is from kind of what I associate you with, which began with Hey Faggot and has moved on to Santorum and other highs or lows, depending on your point of view. And did you decide to make kind of a change in tone when you launched It Gets Better? Was that something, because it seems, though, as commendable, it seems kind of less fierce and hilarious.
Well, there are some fierce and hilarious It Gets Better videos
sure.
That we were told we should take down, and we said no. There's these two gay comedians who do YouTube videos in L.A. who made a totally hilarious video. At one point, they're like, oh, we're talking to teenage gay boys. Let's make sure they're entertained. And they snap their fingers, and the room's full of half-naked WeHo types in their underwear just, like, lounging around, and they keep talking. And people are like, oh, that's too dirty. You should take that down. It's like, no. That's, like, one of the ways it gets better is you get to have friends who look good in their underwear laying around your apartment one day. And eventually you'll have a sense of humor about this shit, too, that you're
right.
going through now. But it wasn't, you know, there are times in the column when it gets serious and times when, you know, you write about serious stuff and times when you don't. And this was a time that you write about serious stuff or a time we were addressing kind of a serious issue. I feel like we were still who we were, but we were just talking about, I was still who I was. What's weird about it is people say now, oh, you did that It Gets Better thing, and you just said that horrible thing about Marcus Bachmann, bully. It's like, you know, adults taking the piss out of each other in the political arena, that's not bullying. And
right.
You have all these Republican politicians now who are hiding behind bullied 13-year-old and 14-year-old queer kids and saying, you can't come after us because you don't want us beating the shit out of these kids, right? And it's so deeply hypocritical. We're setting the bar pretty low. Let's not bully vulnerable teenagers to death. How about that?
Yeah.
But adults can still scream and yell at each other.
Yeah, and I don't know. What I always think about that is like kind of when I see a right-wing homophobic politician cowering in a corner and afraid to go to Congress, then maybe we can say he's been bullied. But like
yes.
if he's just kind of irked one day...
Now, Sarah Palin brought chewing tobacco to make fun of Michael Bloomberg to some speech she gave. And I sent out a tweet saying, Sarah Palin being into chewing tobacco is making me reconsider my feelings about oral cancers. Oral cancers aren't funny unless Michael Douglas is talking about them. And... I got...
That wasn't funny either.
I got, oh, you're bullying Sarah Palin. It's like, I'm not fucking bullying Sarah Palin. It's adults who hate each other taking the piss out of each other. That's different than I'm beating the fuck out of some 14-year-old in a gym somewhere.
Do you think that victimization is honest that they feel? Or you think it's all...
Oh, it's bullshit. They want to be able to... The way the world's supposed to work for these conservatives is I get to punch you in the face and you have to stand stock still. And if you move, you're oppressing me. That's the whole Catholic Church's point now. All these people who are opposed to gay marriage. It's not compulsory. You don't have to get gay married. But just knowing that you got gay married somehow oppresses them. It sort of interferes with their freedom to live in a world where you're not free.
I completely agree. I just also think there's a segment of America that's a large one that feels completely marginalized by where the culture is going. And I think that they...
As well they should.
Yeah, well, perhaps, but I think they're in pain. I think that's on... the phobia part of homophobia.
Then they can join a support group and we can be there and we can tell them what it felt like when we were in the fucking margins. And we can tell them it gets better once you get the fuck over this shit. Once you stop hating, then you're not in the margins anymore. But I, you know, sometimes I go on Christian radio, and one of the things I do talk about is, you can still hate us so hard. You can hate the shit out of us. You just can't have your hatred be enshrined in the law anymore. You can disapprove of interracial marriage. You can't stop people who are interracial couples from marrying anymore.
Right.
You can still be a racist douchebag piece of shit and hate that. And hate it really hard and not go to that wedding and growl and, you know, sneer at that couple. Whatever you want to do, like, knock yourself out. You just can't say it should be against the law because I have a hate boner about it. And so sometimes I say to these right-wing Christians, like, hate me all you want. Hate me so hard and I'm going to go to hell and isn't that enough? Or don't you believe I'm going to hell?
Right.
Like, if you really think that I'm going to hell for all eternity for this, and I'm going to roast on a spit...
Well, I think they'd prefer that you not have a good time and then go. I don't...
That's probably it.
I mean, but that was, for me, one of the most fascinating parts of the debate with Brian Brown, is that you reached that point where you were trying to ask him what harm your marriage was doing to the world, and his answer was, well, the more of marriages there are like that, then kind of the less seemly it gets to hate people like that. It was a Mobius strip of kind
yes.
of insecurity that I found kind of, I mean, so spooky to look at.
Yeah, they feel
that's
like
not a question, Rod.
They're going to be treated like bigots now.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And that's one of the things that drives me crazy about Brown and about others of them. They say they don't hate us, but they then say we're destroying the family, we're a threat to the survival of the species, we're a threat to our own children. I would hate us if I believed those things were true.
Right.
So why not proudly hate us? Why this, like, I love you, smile, love the sinner, hate the sin? If you believe that I am a threat to the survival of the species, which the Pope said, the previous Pope, the Dowager Pope, said, you should hate me. So you either don't believe it, or you just don't want the public shame that comes with being an admitted, honest hater anymore. Or now. So, fuck you, Pope.
So when you were 15 and inhaling this hatred that was around you, and there was no it gets better.
There was.
Well, tell the story.
Oh,
I've read the book.
Is that where you're going?
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I just work here.
We're going to speak in code.
Yeah. tell them about Thingy, you know.
One of the questions I get asked often when people ask me about the It Gets Better Project is, do I wish there was an It Gets Better Project for me when I was a teenager? And I tell this story, and it's in the book, and I was 10, 11, 12, I don't remember, in line for the movies with my parents and my three siblings at Water Tower Place in Chicago to see Logan's Run. And Michael York in Logan's Run, oh my God, strapped to a table. I remember that to this day. With Farrah Fawcett torturing him, like, how hot was that? And there were two guys in line in front of us, like three or four people in front of us, holding hands. And my mother pulled me to her, not my siblings, just me, and looked at my father and said, "They're weird. They're weird." And she kept saying weird, weird, weird about these guys, and which just made me look at those guys, and I went, "Oh, now I get it. I'm weird like they're weird." And I looked at them, and I thought, they look happy. They look like they're in love. I'll be fine. And it like makes me cry to this day to think about them, those two guys. I wish I could find them and thank them, because they gave me hope. Like Harvey Milk said, we were supposed to, or people were supposed to, and being out does for the little queer kids who are still in the closet. And just that public and very brave act in 1976 sure. in a movie theater in Chicago, that got me, and it reached me, and it made me think, all right, I can go underground, if, you know, five more years, and I'll be fine. And a couple of years later, I had a similar reaction to seeing Boys in the Band, which so many other gay people were traumatized by when they saw that when they were very young. And I just thought, oh, I'll be fine. They have great, look at that apartment, New York. And they have friends and they have sex and I'll have better friends than some of these guys. And when the party starts to take this turn, I'll leave, but I'll be all right.
And where do you think the wherewithal came from? I mean, it's when I read that story, I know so many people who saw gay couples when they were young and reacted with horror, thought, oh, now I know what I am, and I don't want to be that, and this is a horrifying thing.
I always, you know, I sometimes, people divide, like, gay people up in, like, gay people who had religious upbringings or didn't, and you know, the different ways that you become gay or react and the impact that can have on you. And for me, gay people, queer people, mostly just gays and lesbians, kind of fall into these two camps. You know, when I get to know gay people, I can almost tell how they reacted after I get to know them a little bit when they realized that they were gay. And there are two groups. There are the kids who thought, oh, I'm gay, there's something wrong with me. And the kids who thought, I'm gay, there's something wrong with everybody else. I'm fine, everybody else is fucked in the head about me. And I was one of those kids. When I realized I was gay, I was like, oh, this is fine. And in some ways, my Jesuit education and my Catholic education brought me to that conclusion. Like, this is literally doing no harm to anyone. It cannot be immoral.
Right.
Because it harms no one. It takes nothing away from anyone. It picks no one's pocket, breaks no one's leg, like Jefferson said. This isn't, this cannot be a sin. I'm fine. The Catholic Church is wrong. And my parents are wrong. And my siblings are wrong. And my teachers are wrong. And I don't know where that came from. But I had it, and I think it came from my parents.
I like that you're blaming it on the Jesuits, though.
And our new Jesuit pope, who says atheists are going to heaven, and then is contradicted by the Curia. He's infallible, but he's wrong.
Yeah. Even infallible people screw up from time to time.
Right.
Yeah.
Did we say infallible? We meant inflammable. He can't burn.
He's unbelievable.
I know.
Do you think the It Gets Better videos reach both kinds of kids that you
yes.
just described?
One of the difficult things about talking about the It Gets Better Project, there's a lot of critics of the It Gets Better Project, and the It Gets Better Project is criticized for not doing what we never said it would.
Right.
We never said it would end bullying. It's not an anti-bullying campaign. It is reaching a kid at a moment when they're vulnerable, and some kids who aren't in a position to make any radical changes or even come out, and just to like give them an image of this future. And the research and the science is there that backs that up, that is valid and helps. But there have been other suicides. We never said it would end LGBT youth suicide. And
right.
when a kid kills himself, people come after me and say, see, it didn't work. They don't write...
This just in.
They don't write newspaper stories about kids who haven't killed themselves. We hear from those kids all the time. And you don't have to take our word for it or my word for it. You can actually go to the YouTube videos, because everyone who created a YouTube video for the It Gets Better Project had to create their own account and upload their video. And they all have their own individual comment threads. And you can see the creators of these videos interacting in real time with the young people who are watching them. And you can see kids getting referrals, getting help, getting the support that they need in that moment. You can see lives being saved just by reading these comment threads. And so we know that it's helped. We know that it's reached kids. We know that it's saved lives. You know, the one letter that pierced my heart. And so much goodwill, sort of ooey-gooey, up-with-people crap sort of congealed around the It Gets Better project. It became very safe. Corporations did it.
Right.
The president did it. Sports franchises did it.
Apparently some without knowing it.
Right. And what people sort of lose sight of is that it's an act of cultural defiance. There's an upraised middle finger at the heart of the It Gets Better project, because what it says is, we're going to talk to your queer kids whether you want us to or not. And it says to homophobic parents, game over. We are bringing the LGBT youth support group to your kid. We're not waiting for you to bring your kid to the LGBT support group anymore, right, or to move to a part of the country that has one. We are going into your house and into your schools using this technology. We got this letter, it came to the Savage Love email, from this 15-year-old girl who said that she was being bullied growing up in a rural area in Texas, went to her parents and came out and told them that she's a dyke and she needs their love and support. She's being bullied and she's at the end of her rope. And her parents threatened to kick her out of the house, threatened not to pay for education, not to ever let her see her younger siblings again, forced her into a reparative therapy program at their shitty fucking megachurch, and told her that she had to change. And so she did what so many LGBT kids have done and some should do under that circumstance. She lied to her parents and told them that she's not a lesbian, that she was confused, and now she sees the light, and she's not into women anymore, or she's not a dyke. Up goes the Justin Bieber poster on the wall, because that's as close to lesbianism as she's going to get for a few years. And here's what she said in the letter.
It's pretty close.
It is pretty close. And we're not making fun of effeminate boys. They're my favorite kind when we say that about Justin Bieber. Here's what she said in her letter that just like explains what the project does. She says, I'm watching It Gets Better videos on my phone, in my bedroom, under the covers, in my parents' house, in the middle of the night. And they're giving me hope, because I'm seeing adults whose parents have the same reaction my parents are having when they came out, who have friends who love them, who have partners, families of their own now, live in better places, and are making it and are fine. And it had put that image in her head that she didn't have. But the thing she said that really killed me, and that I didn't expect, because I was reading her letter and I was so angry at her parents and I wanted to drive to Texas and kill her parents. And she said at the end of the letter, and because of the videos, every day I get up and I go downstairs, I know this by heart, every day I get up and I go downstairs and I look at my mother and my father and I love them for who they're going to be in 10 years. And she has that image of who her parents can be and the change that can come over the parents of a queer kid, because she's seen parents in It Gets Better videos apologizing to their kids for the way they treated them when they were her age. And this is... this is someone who cannot come out, who cannot march into her school and form a GSA, who can't kick ass, who can't make a move. And those were the kids, like the Billy Lucases in Greensburg, Indiana. Those were the kids we were thinking of when we created the project. The ones who were really stuck, and just to give them that download and that image. And for her now, I try not to say, we're going to talk to your kids whether you want us to or not. When I talk about the project, I try to say, we're going to talk to your kids whether you realize right now that you want us to. You want us to, you just don't know it yet. And one day you will thank us for talking to your kids when you're failing them so spectacularly. And that letter, and what kills me right now is I haven't heard from her in a year. And I'm just sort of anxious to hear from her again.
Sure. That's an amazing story, though. And it's wonderful to watch them. I think what's magical, it's definitely... a playlist you can fall into for the rest of the day if you're not careful, if, say, you're prepping for an interview. and it's such a mosaic of individuality, and that's what I mean, among...
And the videos we hear from, the young people who write to us or write to me, it's never, I watched the Green Bay Packers video or the Cubs video. Like that girl, that 15-year-old girl in Texas, it's always about the average, ordinary, everyday LGBT people who created these videos. There are probably fewer than 300 corporations. Not that the corporation videos aren't moving. Some of them are great. Pixar's the Gaps, Googles. Those are great and moving stories. But there's only about 300 celebrities, politicians, and corporations.
Right.
There are 100,000 plus average, everyday, ordinary LGBT people and their videos and their testimonies. And what we hear from so many of the kids who talk to us are those are the ones that do the most good for them, that really reach them.
You have so many people want to ask you questions, and we're going to go to Q&A, but first I'm going to make you a drink.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. It has become a Commonwealth Club tradition that I make drinks.
It must have been, when you did this with Rachel Maddow, that must have been intimidating because she's such a cocktail smith.
I wasn't afraid of her.
All right.
But you're the first, well, I guess her too, but usually I want to make sure the person drinks because I think how awkward that will be with me having two drinks and the guest having none. But you are so famed not only for drinking but for working under the influence, which is...
That is right.
As a lightweight writer, I find that very inspiring.
I do some of my best advising drunk.
I do some of my worst writing.
I always say in a column when I'm drunk and writing, like, take this with a grain of salt. Here we go. Airport bars.
Sorry?
Airport bars.
Airport bars.
A shout out for airport bars.
Yeah, airport bars. It's like the worst hashtag ever.
I'm going to start that hashtag
airport
right now.
Airport bars, who's in? Yeah. I have $30, but I only want to have one drink. Where can I go?
Airport bars or Miami, one or the other.
This is a drink I've invented called the American Savage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it will be served in airport bars, never. It's two parts rye, American, one part Campari, Savage. And then we will shake it up and we will put champagne on top, which is gay. And before I go to the audience questions, I have one just kind of Dan Savage question that I would write in about. And it's, I want to know your opinion on the, whether it's okay at all in a changing room in a gym for men to be drying their genitals with a common use hair dryer.
No. I didn't even have to know.
Yeah.
You could have gone anywhere with that, and the answer is still no.
Okay. Because I wanted that said on stage at San Francisco for people who object to it and are waiting for public opinion to make it a thing of the past. A common use hairdryer. What's wrong with people?
Yay!
Yay!
That looks delicious. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Sorry, there's not enough for everybody.
Contact high.
Only for me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you. Oh, that's delicious.
Yeah.
Don't put that away.
Don't worry.
Ingredients, keep them out.
I'm kind of done now, so it's great. All right.
There's so many worse things people do in gym bathrooms. But yeah, I think you shouldn't abuse a common use hairdryer in any way.
No. It's kind of gross on your hair, is how I feel. I don't know why. I know it's not touching anything.
And they put the foot up on the sink and they
it's
stand
not
there.
Okay at all. Yeah. And although, also, if you give them a look like this, they're just like, what? I don't, which is not okay either.
What, do you expect me to put a damp ball sack in my pants?
Yeah. Right, yeah. What am I...
Are you a barbarian?
I don't want to be like, I'll give you a hint. It's wrapped around your waist. It's called a towel. It's right there. What has been your most challenging parenting moment as an adoptive parent?
We try to let DJ have his life off the record a little bit. There have been moments, peculiar to the adoption. You know, we did an open adoption. DJ's birth mom is in his life. That's been a challenge because DJ's birth mom has certain challenges that I've written about. She was a homeless street kid when we did the adoption, and she still has some of the same issues and problems, although she's not homeless anymore. And keeping them connected was a lot harder and a lot more work than we expected that it would be. And birth relatives sort of popped up every once in a while and came out of the woodwork. And there was, you know, dysfunction and a little bit of craziness, and that was an added kind of burden. And at once sort of wanting to bring DJ together with his birth family, but wanting to protect him from the dysfunction.
Sure.
And trying to balance that was very difficult. There hasn't really been anything about sort of the gay thing that has played out.
Yeah, you're very brave to come out with your son's heterosexuality in the book.
Yeah, DJ came out to us as straight. And I think he had to do that because when he was 9 years old, he doubled down on, I'm going to be gay when I grow up because I hate girls. And we were standing there going, hating girls when you're a nine-year-old boy is not evidence of homosexuality.
Right.
But he didn't believe us. I hate girls. I'm going to be gay like you guys. And we were like, ha, 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 ha. Here's your father's 9th birthday party, and those are all girls around the table except for Terry.
It says I'm supposed to say the name of the speaker, and I think all the questions are anonymous. But it seems like having some sort of sexual perversion is the new norm. As a heterosexual fella, without a fetish, fella without a fetish, they call him.
It sounds like a song from an Asker and Hammerstein musical.
Yeah.
I'm just a fella without a fetish. I can't be prissy or quaint.
Yeah.
How can I fist
as a heterosexual fella without a fetish, they cut that from Oklahoma at the last rehearsal. Yeah. I feel boring. Have I just not found my thing?
I feel
thing?
Boring. Oh, so boring.
Have I not found my thing, or am I normal?
No, you're actually abnormal, because most people have something from column C for crazy. You know, column A, we're fucking things. Column B, we're sucking and licking and slapping things a little bit. Column C, whoa, we're getting pissed on. Most people have something from column C, which is not to stigmatize people who don't. You shouldn't feel bad that vanilla works for you. That's awesome. We don't want the shift to be from everyone who wasn't strictly vanilla feeling like perverts and feeling stigmatized to people who are vanilla feeling stigmatized. We just want everyone to be free to pursue whatever it is that turns them on. And you should be free to pursue whatever it is that turns you on. And if just the regular column A sort of standard issue, fucking fun things turn you on, awesome. You're not going to go broke at Mr. S. And I have a problem with people who are poly or people who are super kinksters or people who are whatever sneering at the vanillas or sneering at people who are, you know, being sexually conservative.
Nice, polite applause from the vanilla crowd. Hear, hear.
All the vanilla people were forced to sit in the back three rows.
That's right.
Because we were oppressing them. I have a problem with people sneering, as some people do. You know, you can be sexually conservative or vanilla and be completely liberated. And you can be sexually crazy and kinky and be completely fucked up. That being sort of on the wild side sexually or part of the sort of sexual edge doesn't mean you're necessarily healthier or more evolved than somebody who's standard issue, monogamous, vanilla, hetero, missionary, once a week, lights out. That can be exactly what they both wanted. And if what you wanted was hanging by your ankles in a dungeon, you guys are both doing exactly what you both wanted to do. And
possibly
you're equally
in the same room. It's dark.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And both those modes of sexual expression can be equally healthy and equally self-actualized, and nobody has to sneer at each other.
Now, there's often two kind of narratives put on kink. And this is a variation of several questions that are in here. One is that You have a kink and it sits in your head and finally you're able to express it and it's a liberated moment. And another is that kink gets put into your head by filthy columns found in the stranger. Do you think there's anywhere on that spectrum? I mean, it's not the
latter.
Yes,
I think it's both.
Right.
You know, I have a lot of friends who are super duper kinky. I'm not super vanilla myself, necessarily. Terry has an account at Mr. S, practically. And there's sort of two people you'll meet at an event like IML. Terry and I just went to the International Mr. Leather Contest in Chicago. We both like leather bars, and it turns a hotel into a huge leather bar for a weekend. It's a total blast, and we have lots of friends who go, and we go. And there's two kinds of people you'll meet at a big kink event, like Folsom or IML, or the straight ones whose names I don't know, because why would I know them? You meet people who were beating off about their kinks and tying themselves up when they were 13 years old. And you meet people who, when they were 28, fell in love with somebody who was kinky and got kinky and sort of tapped into it somehow. It actually reached them, touched them, and brought something out in them that they didn't know was there. And so I think it can be both, that somebody can be sort of born kinky and it's always been a part of their sexual makeup and their erotic imagination and their desire. And then there are people who sort of move into it because they're attracted to someone or into somebody who's kinky. And things they would never have done before, you fall in love with somebody, you know, Bill O'Reilly wants to piss in your mouth, you're like, no. Ryan Gosling wants to piss in your mouth, you're like, ooh. I'm going to think about that one for a minute. Let me get back to you, Ryan Gosling.
How about Ryan Gosling and Bill O'Reilly's mouth?
Ooh, what a waste of Ryan Gosling's piss that would be. I don't know what I meant by that, but
yeah,
but at the Family Research Council, if you're filming tonight, I'm sure that'll be in the clip reel.
Megan and Sarah write, we are a lesbian couple expecting our first child and just found out we're having a boy. Think of the hisses if they found out they were having a girl. Wes, your best advice for two moms raising a son in today's world?
It's my advice would be gender nonspecific. Tell everyone for your shower, no stuffed animals unless you want to be carting crates of them to the dump in a year. No clothes for under ones. And remember, when you're parents, the only time you remember why you liked each other well enough to want to have a kid together in the first place is when you're away from your fucking kid together. It is really important. Everybody that we met in Parentlandia after Terry and I crossed over, who bragged about the fact that they hadn't been to a movie in 3 or 4 or 5 years, that they had never been away from their child, that they could never leave the kid with a babysitter or with a grandparent, all those motherfuckers divorced. We're still together, and the other parents we know who wear it a little bit more lightly, who are willing to, it takes a village thing, and carve out some time for themselves as a couple, they're still together, and that's better for their kids, for them to be still together if they have a healthy and functional relationship. So get the hell away from your son every once in a while.
Yeah. And choose lullabies carefully, that's what I think, because you're stuck, you have to sing it. If you sing it once, you got to sing it the rest of your life.
Maybe This Time is what I sang to DJ when he was little.
Oh, yeah?
From Cabaret, which is weird, but he used to fall asleep to Maybe This Time, and he would die if he knew I just told 1,000
yeah.
people that.
Let's Go to Bed by The Cure. That's what I sing about my son.
But raise it, you know, have men in your life. I'm sure you do, right? But I don't think kids look at their parents and think, there's the penis parent and there's the pussy parent, and how awesome. And I think all people are bits of masculine and feminine traits, and I think that's one of the superpowers of queer parents, is we demonstrate that those things can be united in one human. And so I don't feel like DJ in our house lacked for feminine role models, even in our house, even when it was just the three of us, because in some ways Terry's very feminine, in some ways I'm very feminine. I bake. And so I don't think as queer parents we have to be too self-conscious about the fact that sometimes we're raising a straight kid in our case, or a male child in the case of a lesbian couple. There are too many men in the world for your child to not run into them every once in a while.
Speaking of running into people, if you could have a threesome with anyone living or dead, excluding Terry, who would it be?
Oh my God. I was just going to say Cord Overstreet and Terry. So Cord Overstreet and Cord Overstreet's identical twin.
I don't know who Cord Overstreet is.
He's the trouty mouth, pretty blonde from Glee.
Ah.
And I want to put my dick in his mouth so he'll stop singing.
Whatever works. I have peripheral
vision. Be very quiet, Cord. You're sucking my dick. They don't call it a Hummer for nothing, right? Every once in a while, someone really tries that.
In your time in the public limelight, what has been your proudest moment?
Oh, my God. Writing op-eds for the New York Times. I'm a weirdo. I grew up reading a lot of papers and been subscribed to the New York Times forever. When somehow I managed to leverage the dirtiest sex advice column in America to I get to opine on the pages of the New York Times, when I do get published in the New York Times, I'm always like, wow, weird and awesome and fucked up. And those are really my proudest moments. I was sort of thinking, you know, maybe the It Gets Better project got an Emmy. We got the Governor's Award, which is an award that's usually given to people like Bob Hope the day before he dies. It's this honorary, like, amazing contribution to humanity award. And we were given that, and Terry and I got to walk out on stage at the Emmys and accept this award. And that was really a very bizarre moment. And very, you know, kind of a high point, like, fucking weird, and it's on our mantle. But that was an award that wasn't for us, and we were very clear about that in the remarks that we made, that they were giving this award to the It Gets Better project, and it is what it is because so many thousands of people have made videos, so that wasn't an achievement of ours. We made one video and we did an ask, and everybody came through, and that Emmy was for, if there's anybody in this room who made a video, you won an Emmy.
Yes, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Holy biceps, Dan Savage. What's your food and exercise regime?
Our son is 15 and has nothing to do with us at the moment. As a normal 15-year-old would and should, he's like off doing his things with friends. And Terry's the stay-at-home parent, and Terry's like, I have nothing to do. Like about 2 years ago, he said, I have nothing to do. I think I'm going to start going to the gym. Which means you have to go to the gym. And then that turned into supplements, and then that turned into eating 50 eggs at a go. So a lot of protein, and we go to the fucking gym. And it's good to go to the gym.
And when you get out of the shower...
Yes, we blow dry our balls. But we have Cord Overstreet do it for us. You just... In our dreams, right?
Yeah, his voice is so small next to the laugh of the air. Do you think there is a finite set of kinds of sexuality? Says, it looks like M.D. Pacer.
That's a
street name.
That's a trick question. Because if I say yes, then I'm some sort of bigot when the next, like, thinly sliced identity is created. So I will say no. There is an infinite number of sexualities and genders, and we all need Excel spreadsheets now to keep track of our friends. LGBTQ, TSLF, Q again, A for the asexuals. It's time to sing the alphabet song and be done with it.
Yeah.
Or just go for queer. I love queer. Queer is genus, and everything else is species. I'm queer. What's your species? Gay queer. So I'm done with the LGBT, blah, 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 blah. I'm for queer. And then when you tell people you're queer, you have to tell them what else you are. Homo sapien.
Right.
Queer gay.
Mormon. Speaking of which, there are many poly questions here. What are resources or ways that can help guide single monogamists who are entering for the first time into a relationship with someone who's poly?
Tristan Taramino wrote a terrific book called Opening Up. And I think that that's a really great place to start, Tristan's book. And there are a lot of poly blogs. out there, and I actually find those very helpful, and I direct people to them all the time. Poly ain't for everybody. Poly isn't a more evolved state. Jealousy is natural, even in a polyamorous relationship, even in an open relationship. Some people feel like they're failing at polyamory or they're failing at openness if they experience jealousy. And it's actually how you handle and process jealousy that proves that you can have a polyamorous or open relationship, because you will have moments of jealousy. And how you work through that as a couple or a triad or a quad or a quint proves that you can fucking do this thing. So don't be, A, self-conscious if you feel jealous, and B, don't feel like you failed poly if you realize that this ain't for you.
Do you have some concern, because you've brought kind of monogamish and poly relationships into the forefront, that you are...
responsible for every poly relationship?
Yeah. No. But it does seem like you've gone a long way to make that sexual identity kind of currently cool.
But there are some people in polyland who think I'm an anti-poly bigot, because I think poly is a relationship model and not an orientation.
Right.
I think it's a relationship model that makes some people a whole hell of a lot happier than monogamy. And I don't think monogamy makes many people too ecstatically happy. But, you know, poly has a way, and openness can, you know, visit its own miseries on a couple or a triad or a quad or great. What was the question? Pot. Legal. Washington.
My question was, what's your favorite Bob Marley song? You big stoner.
I don't know any Bob Marley songs. I get stoned and listen to Gypsy. If Mama was married, I'd have another joint.
I'm going to top you off, as they say. And then, sadly, we have reached the end of the evening. Mr. Savage signing books, and there is a traditional final question here at the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, in which we ask our guests for the 60-second solution to the world. You can have a little more of the
Please. The 60-second solution. Oh, you warned me about this, and I completely forgot.
Yeah.
Can I just run out the clock by thinking?
No.
No? Just, oh my God, if the Family Research Council
is here.
You're
so good at solving problems. Come on.
I just feel like so much at the root of human conflict is religion. And if I could reach into, you know, the great big computer program that is human culture and human society and rip out some motherboards, it would be those fucking motherboards. I say that as somebody who still walks into churches and sits in quiet contemplation, because it carves so deep a groove into me. And it just lends itself so to tribalism. You know, I think of that physicist who said that good people will do good and evil people will do evil with or without religion. But to get good people to do evil, that takes religion. And I just, you know, you look around the world right now, and most of the conflicts are about faith and people blowing each other up and about it. And it just, I just think that lovely art and architecture and churches and Gothic cathedrals and Islamic art, and there's all this beauty and, you know, Angkor Wat and temples and statues of Buddha and riots and sectarian violence and Irish people blowing up cars in London, and the Catholics and the Protestants murdering each other in Northern Ireland, and it just, the costs that come with religion, I just feel so sometimes outweigh the benefits. And I wish, as we knew more about why the world spins and how our universe came into being, that we could let go of the myths and the stories that we made up once upon a time to explain it to ourselves when we were living in deserts and we didn't know if the sun was going to come up again tomorrow, and we needed some reassurance. And the whole we're cows with big brains problem. And that we can conceive of our own mortality in this way. And we don't want to die. Non-existence terrifies us. We make up bullshit stories about afterlives and heavens and hells and gods and demons. And it just needs to stop. At some point, we need to... evolve out of religion if we're going to survive as a species on this planet in particular.
Well, sadly, that is the end
of
the evening. Thank you so much for joining us at the Commonwealth Club. Mr. Savage will be signing books. It is great to connect your intellect.
Thank you all very much.
Good night, everybody.